Support comes from Gemma, architects, planners, and designers seeking to bring joy to their clients and communities. Details at gemastl.com.
This is St. Louis on the Air from St. Louis Public Radio. I'm Elaine Cha. In summer 2024, our region recognized the 10-year anniversary of Michael Brown Jr.'s killing by then-Ferguson police officer Darren Wilson. The massive protests and global attention that ensued changed more than the St. Louis suburb of Ferguson alone. It inspired communities to consider how their police and court systems were actually functioning and how those relationships and trust could be rebuilt. Those efforts have taken different forms. The city of Ferguson has faced another layer of pressure. In 2016, it entered a binding legal agreement called a consent decree with the U.S. Department of Justice. Now, almost a decade later, Ferguson's residents and officials are eager for that contract to end. And to talk about why that is, I'm joined by STLPR reporter Chad Davis. Chad, welcome back to the show.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
So Chad, the Ferguson Consent Decree has been around since 2016, and you had a chance to interview Patricia Washington, and she's in charge of monitoring the agreement between Ferguson and the federal government. So we're going to hear a little of your interview in just a bit, but to lay some groundwork for that, what does this consent decree actually represent?
Yeah, so the consent decree represents different reforms that the city of Ferguson and the police department had to make. This was after the 2016 report by the DOJ found that there were constitutional violations between the police department and also constitutional violations in certain things with the municipal code and court system. So there are 19 areas in the consent decree, and it's pretty much telling Ferguson that you have to do these things to reform areas in the police department, the court system, and the municipal code in order to be in full compliance with the federal government.
Mm-hmm. Who's checking that those things are getting done?
So there is a monitoring team that is pretty much kind of in charge of making sure that these changes are compliant with what needs to happen. So this monitoring team, they're made up of legal experts, lawyers, people who can look and say, we need more of this, or maybe this needs to change, or this needs to happen. So you have that. You, of course, have the Department of Justice, which were the ones who found in the first place that there were these issues within Ferguson. And then you do have the consent decree coordinator, who in a lot of ways tries to implement a lot of these things to get some of these changes made. And then you have a judge who oversees the entire process.
Mm-hmm. So there are a lot of people involved here, a lot of agencies.
Exactly.
There are a lot of people who are looking forward, as we mentioned in that intro, to the end of the consent decree. But there are different opinions regarding when and how it should end. And some want the city of Ferguson to basically declare that it's over unilaterally. So help us understand what the different sides of this are.
Yeah, so there is a side that is wanting it to end, and wanting it to end because of the cost of this. So since 2016, it's been roughly about $6 million or so that the city has had to spend on the decree to try to get to compliance. And so you have some people who have been critical of the amount of money that they've had to spend. They'll say and talk about how a lot of the people who may have caused some of those issues within the city, they're no longer there, they're gone. And they want to use that money, or use the money that is being used for the consent decree, for things like road repairs, things that can go to infrastructure, things that can go back to people who are actually living in Ferguson. However, the judge has also talked about how there's been a lot of progress that's been made. And there are a lot of people who are also within Ferguson who are talking about some of that progress that has been made. And a lot of that progress has happened over the last few years or so. And so you've got people who are saying, you know, if we cut the funding to this consent decree right now, are we going to be compliant? Are we going to not have the subject matter experts who are going to be here to tell us that these things are accurate?
What is the case for not waiting for the Department of Justice and ending the consent decree now?
So with that case, it's more of a money situation where it's that there's been a lot of money that has been spent on this consent decree for the past 10 years almost, and that a cut now would, you know, save some of that money, would save some of that money that would go back into other different things within Ferguson, whether that's infrastructure or other programs. So there's been a lot of discussions about that.
Mm-hmm. So can Ferguson unilaterally say, we're done with this?
It's a tricky thing. Only a judge can end a consent decree. The judge is the only body that can say, you know what, we don't want this consent decree anymore. And that's because there has been this agreement between Ferguson and the judge for the past 10 years. Now, there are questions that if funding is pulled, does that mean that they are no longer compliant? Maybe there is a case that can be made for that, but only a judge can end a consent decree.
Chad Davis is a reporter with St. Louis Public Radio. Last week, he sat down with Patricia Washington. She's the public information officer for the Ferguson Police Department. Last year, she took the role of coordinator for the federal consent decree with the United States Department of Justice. Chad began the interview by asking Patricia Washington to describe what it was like taking on the duties of making sure the consent decree is successful.
The first thing that I wanted to know for myself was, where was the city with the consent decree? Not just the police department, because the consent decree has the police department, the courts, and municipal reform, right? So I wanted to know where we were, and I couldn't get a straight answer anywhere. It was, you know, a lot of things had been done. A lot of work had been done, a lot of hard work around community building. But nobody could definitively tell me, you know, this is where we are and this is what we need to do. So the first thing that I did, even before becoming the consent decree coordinator, was create my own sort of little spreadsheet, tracking sheet. You know, this is what I know has been done. And that is what led me to realize, oh my goodness, there's a lot more work to do.
And obviously this is like an estimation, but if you had to like think about like a percentage mm-hmm. of like where it was at that time, roughly what would that percentage have been?
I have to look at it in terms of percentages in the various areas, right? Municipal courts was maybe 70% done. The city was maybe 70-80%. And the police department was lagging behind. We might have been 50-60% complete with the work needed to do.
Okay, so fast forward now. You've been at the consent decree coordinator for now almost 2 years?
Mm-hmm, about a year and a half.
Year and a half. So what have you accomplished at this point, and how much still needs to be done?
Okay. So one of the first things that I did was create our exit strategy. How do we finish this work? And how do we make sure that the systems that we put in place are lasting? So we had a strategic plan put together and then started just breaking everything off by those categories. What needs to be done in courts? We have an amazing courts administrator. Michelle Richmond is phenomenal. She and her team have courts in 99% compliance. And that's everything from rewriting policies to how people pay for their court fees and fines, right? So we took a look at each area and devised a strategy for coming into compliance in each of those areas. But more importantly, a timeline. What's our time frame? How long is it going to take us to complete these 180 tasks left, you know, in courts or what have you? And we meet internally every week, and we look at that, check our work, and check ourselves in terms of, okay, what can be done now? Have we run into a roadblock, which we often do? And then how do we get around that? What's our workaround? And we just keep at it.
What are some of those roadblocks that you all have sometimes?
One of the biggest things that we're facing in the police department is just staffing. The biggest component of the consent decree for the police department really is around training and community policing. Training is very, very difficult when you don't have a full contingent of officers, right? You if you want officers to come in and do a half day or a full day training or a 3 day training, somebody's got to still patrol the streets. You've got to do the training, but you can't call in another police department and say, hey, you know, can you guys take a shift for us? And so that is very, very challenging for us right now. Initially, it was getting all of the training approved because there's such a process for that. You can't just say, oh, we're going to do some training on the First Amendment. No, you have to identify a subject matter expert. They have to develop a curriculum. That curriculum has to be approved by the training committee, which is one of the aspects of the consent decree that's mandated. So there's a civilian training committee. Then it goes to the DOJ for approval. Then it comes back from the DOJ and goes to the monitor for approval. And then once all these approvals are done, you have to figure out how to schedule it. So it could take months just to get one training session offered.
We need to take a quick break, but we'll be back to continue this conversation about the future of Ferguson's consent decree. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio.
Support comes from the St. Louis Public Library Foundation. During these challenging times, free access to digital resources is a necessity. You can help our community stay connected. Support your St. Louis Public Library at slpl.org.
Welcome back. I'm Elaine Cha. Let's return to our conversation about the Ferguson Consent Decree, a legal agreement that was reached between the city of Ferguson and the federal government in the wake of the Ferguson protests more than a decade ago. Before the break, Washington was speaking with STLPR reporter Chad Davis, describing the challenges and delays that have faced this process. Here's Chad.
So what does the timeline look like as far as getting the consent decree completed?
I would say that of all of the activities, the 20 different areas and, you know, the hundreds of things, I would say that we are probably about 90% complete. I would say 90 to 95% complete.
In all areas of the consent decree?
In everything.
Wow.
You know, and that is a huge leap from where we were. But the difference has been just the cadence and the expectation. You know, and having to do that in a very uncertain environment with what's happening with our federal government, with the changeover in the DOJ, with just uncertainty around, is the consent decree even going to be in existence? Is it going to go away? Just being able to move as deliberately and efficiently as we've been able to do over this past, I would say, 8-9 months is phenomenal. I'm so proud of this team.
As far as some of the things that the police department has been working on, I know some of the things that I think one of the things that the report had talked about was also making sure that things as far as body-worn cameras mm-hmm. are, you know, that there's compliance in that, and that making sure that officers, if they turn on their body-worn cam, mm-hmm. that they have to keep them on and stuff like that, or alert residents to make sure that the body-worn cameras are on.
Right.
I know some of those things were still being worked on. Some things were either near compliance or not compliant yet. How has that progress been?
Well, it's funny that you mentioned that because we have another audit coming up just to go back, circle back. The monitor will look at some of those things. And I always remind people that body-worn cameras is a very new thing for our department. And we have a very new department. We are not the department of 2014. As a matter of fact, I would say probably 80% of our officers are all new. We only have a handful who were there in 2014. And they're young. Some of them are straight out of the academy. They have less than 5 years experience. So when you bring in technology like body-worn cameras and the new taser units or electronic weapons devices that we call, and those types of things, there's a learning curve. It's not just about learning how to operate the camera. It is making sure that you are protecting people's First Amendment and their constitutional rights with that camera. As you said, alerting them to the fact that they are being recorded, knowing when you cannot record. If, you know, under what circumstances do you need to turn your body-worn camera off? Can you turn it off? Being able to differentiate between understanding how to even tell a person that they're being recorded. You can't just, well, hey, I'm recording you on my camera. You know, there's a certain way that you have to introduce that conversation to a person. So it's been a big learning curve. And I'm happy to say, though, with the reinforcements, the roll call training, the in-service training, they're doing much better.
So then going to the municipal code and talking about some of those changes and those reforms, where do things stand with that? What are some of the things that you've been able to accomplish over the last year and a half or so since you've taken on this position?
Well, the reform of the municipal code was one of the very first mountains, you know, that we had to climb. And some of the municipal codes were very outdated, and they contributed to some of the actions that were noted in the pattern and practice report. One of the very big ones in the coding was separating municipal courts from the police department. One of the findings showed that the police department at that time, if there was a budget shortfall, they would write tickets to make that up. And so the municipal code reform, in that process, you separated those two. So that can't happen anymore. So that process was really, I think, the first probably 2 to 3 years worth of work is reviewing all those codes. I'm happy to say that those have all been done, but the work is not finished because you still have to review every year to ensure that there's not something that either you've missed or that is no longer valid because there's a change in state law or federal law. So it's a constant process.
And then as far as municipal court reform, mm-hmm. where does that stand right now?
Municipal courts, they are really ready for a compliance finding. There's only one thing that they have to do around self-evaluation and data collection. And once we get approval on the process for doing that, we're going to make a motion to the courts to remove to Judge Perry to remove municipal courts from the consent decree work because we will be in full compliance.
So that means that's been pretty much reformed.
Like the courts that's have been... a huge. What's happened with our courts is nothing short of amazing. Because while most of the attention has been focused on the police department, it was really court reform that was essential in terms of protecting people's rights. And I don't know if you'll recall, there was the allegations about treating people as ATM machines with these fines and fees. That was all court driven. And so to have that be completely gone away, to be in compliance not only with the consent decree, but moving our courts into the St. Louis County court system and the state system with state oversight requires stringent practices and stringent reviews. And so we have been able to exceed what we needed to do in the consent decree because of that.
And so, and just to get into kind of like the details of that, what were some of those things in municipal courts that you had to reform? Some of the things mm-hmm. that the DOJ said you have to make these changes.
Things like bail or if you can't, they had people who were in jail calling relatives to, you know, bring money to do, you know, to pay fines and fees. And then they'd be tripled if you couldn't do that. So being able to follow the Supreme Court rule around fines and fees and bail, all of that had to be reformed. That was one of the big things. And I think the opportunity, one of the things that the consent decree says is that you cannot create artificial barriers for people to be able to pay their fines and fees and avoid, you know, jailing them simply because they couldn't. In other words, essentially creating a debtor's prison. You know, you can't do that. And I just did a little informal like survey one day. I stayed after we had a court session and I noticed this one woman and a young man, they were afraid to come into court. They sat on the parking lot because they were afraid if they came to court, they were going to be jailed because that had been a certain practice. They'd already missed, you know, one court date. But they came in and the judge was so open with them and so honest with them and did bent over backward trying to find a way for them to rectify that situation, giving them an additional court date, not doubling and tripling fines. And when they left, I asked them, you know, how was your experience? And the woman, she almost broke down. I mean, she said, I was terrified. This is Ferguson, after all. To come in here. And she said, I have a new court date. I don't have to be afraid to be driving around. I can go to work. And those are the kinds of impact. That's the kind of change that you want to see.
That's an interesting point because that goes into talking with the community and, mm-hmm. you know, making sure that they feel safe and making sure that they feel okay. How do you do that when Ferguson has, of course, the DOJ report comes out. It says that there are all these systemic practices that target Black people, that target poor people. You know, how do you show the community that things have changed, that things are changing, that it's okay?
Well, I think what you just said, you show them. When I was growing up, you know, my mom used to say, you can make your mouth say anything, right? But it's not about the talk. It's the walk. What are you really doing? What is the impact of the work? Is there somebody who can be like that woman and say, you know, her life was completely changed because she's able to go to work and drive now without fear that, you know, she's going to be pulled over and go to jail? That's the proof. Can you demonstrate? Can you show people that you are not that? And that's what we have to do every day, because that sentiment is still out there. You know, you hear the word Ferguson, it's like, oh my God. And nobody will give us credit for the work. There's so much work that has been done. There are citizen oversight committees. There are intentional engagements with people in our community, particularly our apartment communities, right? When we talk about the people in our apartment communities, most of the time, when they engage with law enforcement, it's not a good day. So you have to show people. I can sit here and give reports all day long about the progress that we've made. All it takes is for one officer to demonstrate otherwise. And everything that we've done, you know, is for naught. So we have to walk the talk.
So the Ferguson City Council, they voted to cut, was it half the funding by the end of this fiscal year or so? Okay. For a consent decree for this fiscal year. When that vote was going, when that vote was happening, when those discussions were happening, I mean, what was going through your head at that time?
Well, the first thing that I thought about was, how do you want to end something without, but it appears to be sabotaging it? You can't do the work without the funding. You want us to be in compliance. You want to get the work over and done with, as you say. You want to be able to redirect those resources. So to me, the fastest way and the most efficient way to do that is to put the necessary resources in so that we can work more efficiently, faster, and get it done. So that was my immediate concern. And then some of the council members shared that what's not about defunding the program side and the training side. We're going to leave all the money in there for training. So we're going to leave, you know, half of the money in there for the community policing and community engagement, the safe streets. No. The biggest part is legally ensuring that we are doing the work and we're in legal compliance. That takes attorneys. And so to say that you want to save on attorney's fees and to cut that payment in half, and I get it. It is expensive. The legal work is expensive, but it is also required. So, I mean, I understand it, and there's this whole trade-off about, well, if we weren't paying for the consent decree and legal fees, we could pay for roads, streets, and bridges. Well, let's look at that. You could pay for roads, streets, and bridges, but if you fail to put the reforms in place and build them in such a way that they are lasting, what you're doing is building a road, street, and a bridge right back into the place where you were that caused you to be in a consent decree in the first place. So it's not one or the other. It's not constitutional policing. It's not reform of your courts or reform or street repair.
It's so when it comes to that money and the things that will get cut, what would be cut with this decision?
I think you're going to have an impact, obviously, in some of the legal guidance. I'd be very afraid about that. When I need to call one of our attorneys because there's an issue or something that we're proposing or we don't know how to come into compliance and need their advice, I'd be worried that we weren't going to be able to get that. If we needed additional support to provide the evidence or the proof to satisfy the monitor in the upcoming audits. If we don't have the guidance of our legal team, I'd be concerned about that. I'm concerned about the fact that we have a number of community engagement initiatives that we need someone to manage and support. The data analysis to determine, are we on the right track? Is there a disparate impact? Are we looking at are we making informed decisions from the data? All of that has to be funded. So I do have some concern about that going forward.
That was STLPR reporter Chad Davis speaking to Patricia Washington earlier this week. Washington serves as the coordinator for the 2016 consent decree agreement between the City of Ferguson and the U.S. Department of Justice. She is also the public information officer for the Ferguson Police Department.
This episode was produced by Danny Wisentowski and recorded by Chad Davis.
Audio editing by our audio engineer, Aaron Dorr.
Our executive producer is Alex Hoyer.
St. Louis on the Air is a production of St. Louis Public Radio. Understanding starts here.
Do you find yourself regularly listening to episodes of St. Louis on the Air? Suggest us to a friend you think might enjoy our conversations. And leave us a review and rating on Apple Podcasts on the App Store. It's the simplest way to help people discover our show. Thank you.
St. Louis Public Radio is a member-supported service of the University of Missouri, St. Louis.
The Gateway brings you the day's news each weekday from around the St. Louis region and the state capitals in Jefferson City.
Our schools are accredited. We don't need this bill.
And Springfield.
How many more years must pass before lawmakers see time is of the essence?
I'm Abby Larico. Join me each weekday for The Gateway on the STLPR app or wherever you get podcasts.